From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Summer Reading, we feature interviews with the authors of three current bestsellers. John le Carré writes fiction about international espionage. He'll tell us about his own experiences as a British spy during the Cold War. His current bestseller is The Night Manager. Also, we talk with Walter Mosley about his Easy Rollins crime series. The latest is Black Betty. It's set in Watts in the early 60s as the civil rights movement is gaining steam. And A Private Eye in the Louisiana Bayou. We hear from James Lee Burke about his series of crime novels set in and around New Orleans. His new one is Dixie City Jam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Clinton administration has announced a new initiative to get food and medicine to sick and starving Rwandans who are encamped on the Zairean border. The president says the United States will support the deployment of UN peacekeepers who will help the refugees go home. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali today appealed to the international community to help resolve the humanitarian crisis in Rwanda. His appeal comes as refugees continue to stream into neighboring Zaire. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Boutros-Ghali addressed the representatives of the governments that make up the United Nations. He told them that the tragedy in Rwanda has assumed unimaginable proportions, touching virtually all of the country's 7 million people.
This disaster, which is taking place before our very eyes, entails our collective responsibility that of the international community as a whole.
The United Nations has convened a pledging conference for August 2nd in Geneva. It's there that Boutros-Ghali hopes governments will announce their contributions. Meanwhile, a spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees today criticized the slow response of the international community. Silvana Foa said it's one thing to have goodwill, but it's another to get relief delivered to Rwanda in a timely manner. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher is on his way back from the Middle East, but he's not discussing his talks there. He ended his latest peace mission with a short stop in Syria, but said nothing publicly during his five-hour stopover. A Syrian spokesman says President Hafez al-Assad listened to the ideas that Christopher brought from his previous trip to Israel. Christopher is supposed to go back to the region in August. A federal judge has ordered South Carolina's military college to admit its first woman. Ashley Byrd of member station WLTR reports.
U.S. District Judge Weston Houck said the Citadel must admit 19-year-old Shannon Faulkner immediately. They must also develop other plans for accommodating women who want a military education. He gave South Carolina until the fall of 1995 to implement that plan. The state has suggested it might create a parallel program for women at another school, similar to what Virginia has done in a case challenging VMI's all-male policy. Faulkner applied to the Citadel last year after she deleted references to her sex on her high school transcript. The college accepted the application, then rejected it upon learning she was a woman. Ms. Faulkner sued. Houck's ruling follows a 10-day trial last May of Faulkner's sex discrimination suit against the school. His order would make Ms. Faulkner the first woman to enter the Corps in the school's 151-year history. For National Public Radio, I'm Ashley Byrd in Columbia, South Carolina.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up a point at 3,733. The NASDAQ Composite Index is also up a point at 716. This is NPR. President Clinton has thrown his support to Democratic congressional leaders who are developing their own health care reform plans. The lawmakers briefed the president and the first lady last night on their efforts. They say their proposals will be less bureaucratic and more voluntary than the administration's plan. They also note their plan would be phased in over a longer period of time. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says the leaders are after the same objectives as the president. The Clintons' main goal has been universal coverage. House Speaker Tom Foley says the proposed changes can attract majority support in both houses of Congress. The Space Shuttle Columbia will set a new endurance record for the program now that NASA has scrubbed plans to bring the astronauts home today. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Thunderstorms near the Kennedy Space Center have forced NASA to leave Columbia in orbit for another day. By stretching the mission into a 15th day, Columbia's crew breaks the old endurance record of 14 days, 13 minutes. The seven astronauts have been working around the clock conducting life sciences research inside the Space Lab module in Columbia's cargo bay. The crew will bring back with them more than 30 fish and 75 Japanese red-bellied newts that were hatched while in orbit. The mission has been relatively smooth to this point, with a few equipment problems. The most notable have been problems with one of the shuttle's three navigational instruments. Officials don't think it will hamper efforts to bring the shuttle home safely, but if the problem worsens, NASA will likely send Columbia to California, where the margin for error is greater. Touchdown tomorrow is now scheduled for 6:39 Eastern Time at the Kennedy Space Center. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Authorities in New Jersey say they're still tracking the source of tainted meat that has sickened eight people. Officials say the victims all have the potentially deadly E. coli bacteria, mainly transmitted through hamburger. Most of the ill are children. Authorities are reminding consumers to thoroughly cook hamburger. The bacteria gained attention last year when there was an outbreak in fast food restaurants. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's our Summer Reading Archive Edition, featuring interviews with authors currently on the bestseller list. First, a 1989 interview with a spy novelist who spends a lot of time on that bestseller list, John le Carré. He's used espionage to get at the complexity of human nature and contemporary history. His books include The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, The Little Drummer Girl, A Perfect Spy, The Russia House, and his current bestseller, The Night Manager. John le Carré is actually a pseudonym. The author's real name is David Cornwell. He used to work for British intelligence. Politically, he's one of the more liberal spy novelists. Even during the Cold War, he didn't write about simple good guys and bad guys.
I wrote about people who were groaning under the weight of the Cold War, who were being deprived of the spirit of optimism, who were working in the dark, really not believing they would ever see the light. I certainly was never a cold warrior in the literary sense, quite the reverse. I felt that people fought the wars they inherited, whether I was writing about the Middle East or about the Cold War.
And you wanted to depict the spy more as a working man, in a way.
Yeah, I knew that world, and I knew the way it had worked, and I knew that what I had seen was ordinary men and women locked in an impossible conflict. They were like flies in aspic.
How were they like flies in aspic?
Well, because we were given these postures, these ideological postures that were irreconcilable, and we worked within them, and we tried to tease the other side. I mean, in the high day of the Cold War, we were into things like trying to screw up youth conferences in Bucharest by putting itching powder on the lavatory seats and things of that sort. I mean, we forget what insanities were performed in the name of ideological purpose.
You use the word we, and I know you worked as a spy for a while. Was this one of your missions, having to put the itching powder on that?
Well, I was an intelligence officer.
Oh, okay.
this was not one of my missions. It's an enchanting notion that it would have been, but I'm afraid not. No, I'm speaking metaphorically. I don't know whether we did that exactly, but it was, that type of thing was constantly on the drawing board or being put into effect.
Did your feelings for the job change as the Cold War progressed?
Yes, a kind of, as the French say, a cafard set in, a weariness of the spirit, which I tried to reflect in such characters as George Smiley. I also began to think it was damn silly that we were coming the victims of our own rhetoric, and that a situation could occur where we could make genuine advances, and we would be so stuck in our own rhetoric that we would never be able to get out of it. I sometimes worry that that's happening now.
When you started writing fiction, whose clearance or permission did you have to get, especially since it was spy fiction?
Well, if I had been even an orthodox foreign servant, I would have had to obtain clearance from my employing department, even if I'd written a book on Lepidoptera. As it was, I submitted my novels, and they never met with any objection. And I think that professional spies, professional intelligence officers reading that material would know, in fact, that these were abstractions from the reality, just as any novel is an abstraction from reality. And they were not disturbed that I had portrayed the authentic world. They became disturbed when they realized that what I had portrayed was much more than authentic, namely, it was credible.
Were they afraid that the kinds of ambiguities that you were raising would be dispiriting to your readers?
Yes, I think so. I think that came back to me at least from one or two espiocrats in the
Americans. Oh, I like that word.
I do too, thank you. It's entered my new book. In the American structure, that I was undermining the very spirit which should fire young recruits to the agency or to the intelligence community. I was very entertained by that.
You were entertained by that?
Yes, because I think that in fact what I did was discuss quite often, rather unmercifully, the impossible gap between the dream and the reality. I said that these were not supermen and superwomen. They were people of ordinary quality, some good, some indifferent, and some lousy, just like in any outfit, who were trying to do an impossible job. I also raised the rather nasty moral question of how much you can do in defense of a society and make sure that its society is still worth defending. That question has bothered Americans a great deal when they've undertaken their own heart-searching about some of the CIA operations.
Writer John le Carré is my guest. Mole is a word that you're credited with having brought into the English vocabulary. I think you borrowed it from the Soviets, really. What was the origin of that?
Well, I thought I borrowed it from the Soviets, but the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary can't find any Soviet reference to mole.
Oh.
The origin was in the notion of a mole, somebody who burrows deep into the fabric of our society, is a little observed, little noticed thing, creature, and then from inside causes its downfall. And it's certainly now become a notion. I think they used to be called sleepers in the CIA, agents you put in place and you don't invite them to do anything risky, anything that could compromise them for years and years and years while they work their way into a position of power.
Coming in from the cold is another expression that you coined.
Well, yes, I suppose so, or at least I applied it to espionage. I suppose I was the first person to do that.
And what was behind that?
Well, behind it was the character of Alec Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, who was an old professional agent, an aging professional agent, who was suffering from what you might call a kind of spiritual metal fatigue. And he was offered one last mission, and he was told that when he had completed it, he could come in from the cold.
But, I mean, how did you come up with the expression?
Well, it's a meteorological perception. It's cold out there and it's warmer indoors, and mm-hmm. The chill comes from a lack of human contact or a lack of human affection, of having to keep what Graham Greene called the chip of ice in your heart all the time, which is also a writer's condition to a point. I guess that even then I was aware of a comparability between the position of a writer in his environment and that of a spy, that both, in a sense, trade off the people around them. They note things and they report them. Both are dependent upon the people they deceive, and both, in a sense, have to be entertainers to be accepted.
Well, how does a writer have to deceive?
Well, I think that chip of ice to which Graham Greene refers is really some kind of recording instrument. L.P. Hartley said, "Don't leave me in your drawing room. I'm sure to read your letters." I don't read people's letters, but there is a part of me, as there is of most artists, that stands back from most experience. I never know whether that is what the French call a professional deformation, which comes from practicing the craft, or whether people of that disposition are drawn to the craft in the first place.
And how does a spy have to be an entertainer?
Most of them have to have entertainment value, particularly if they are going to recruit people. If Alas, we've never met, but I'm sure you're beautiful and young and elegant, and if I were determined to obtain your services and turn you around and get you to report upon your organization, you'd be unlikely to come and have lunch with me if I wasn't a person of some charm and entertainment value.
And knowing how to flatter people.
And knowing how to flatter people, and more particularly knowing how to make people dependent on you, because once I had obtained you, you would then have to continue working for me. And you would have to have a reason, and if it wasn't love, it would have to be ideology, or if it wasn't either of those things, it would have to be money.
John le Carré, recorded in 1989. His current bestseller is called The Night Manager. We'll hear from detective writer James Lee Burke after this break. This is Fresh Air. James Lee Burke writes detective novels set in New Orleans and the surrounding bayou. Joyce Carol Oates described him as one of the gifted contemporary writers responsible for revitalizing the detective genre by bringing in issues of politics, gender, race, and morality. Oates writes, among even his talented contemporaries, Burke is something special. His new novel, Dixie City Jam, is his seventh featuring Cajun detective Dave Robichaud. It just made it onto the Publisher's Weekly bestseller list. Burke got a late start in the field of crime fiction. His first novel was published in 1965, but he went through long periods when no one was interested in bringing out his books. One book was in play for 9 years and was rejected by 100 publishers. It wasn't until the mid-80s that he started writing detective novels. I spoke with him in 1992, after the publication of his novel A Stained White Radiance, in which Dave Robichaud investigates a Klansman-turned-politician and a TV evangelist. Here's a reading.
If you grew up in the Deep South, you're probably fond, as I am, of recalling the summertime barbecues and fish fries, the smoke drifting in the oak trees, the high school dances under a pavilion that was strung with Japanese lanterns, the innocent lust we discovered in convertibles by shattered lakes groaning with bullfrogs, and the sense that the season was eternal, that the world was a quiet and gentle place, that life was a party to be enjoyed with the same pleasure and certainty as the evening breeze that always carried with it the smell of lilac and magnolia and watermelons in a distant field. But there is another memory, too, the boys who went nigger-knocking in the little black community of Sunset, who shot people of color with BB guns and marbles fired from slingshots, who threw M-80s onto the galleries of their pitiful homes. Usually these boys had burr haircuts, jug ears, half moons of dirt under their fingernails. They lived in an area of town with unpaved streets, garbage in the backyards, ditches full of mosquitoes and water moccasins from the coulee. Each morning they got up with their loss, their knowledge of who they were, and went to war with the rest of the world. When we meet the adult bigot, the Klansman, the anti-Semite, we assume that he was bred in that same wretched place. Sometimes that's a correct conclusion. Oftentimes it's not.
Do you know anybody who you grew up with who you feel became, as an adult, one of the kinds of fascists that you're writing about?
Oh, I knew many people who grew up to be like the boys that I describe here in this piece, but these kinds of people are victims themselves. These are fellas, or sometimes women too, who are inept and not quite functional and see themselves as being disenfranchised, and they never know who they are unless they feel superior to some other group, and they're by and large innocuous and bumbling guys with banana peels for fingers. It's hard to look upon them as villains. They're almost like buffoons rather than villainous people. The kind of individual who bothers me most is the one who's calculating, who knows better, and who is of insidious intent. The person who perhaps has sociopathic tendencies, who insinuates himself into the mainstream of society. And he has one message always. He teaches others to fear and to hate our fellow man and to blame others for our own misfortune.
Now, Dave Robichaux, your detective, is drawn to people who are psychologically deformed in some way. I mean, he considers people like that to be like his extended family. the walking wounded, as he describes them. Is that an affinity you feel yourself?
Well, let's face it, who are the most interesting people in our midst? People who get up every morning and do things in a normal way, or the deeply neurotic and brain-fried, the people who begin each day with a nervous breakdown, people who were shot out of a cannon 5 minutes ago. I think they're always more intriguing. I don't know. I've always felt that it's difference that saves us from ourselves. I mean, God help us if we ever become too enamored with normalcy. It's always the person who has the outrageous and eccentric view of the world who leads us away from ourselves, always. Whether it's, we're talking about Newton or Christ or Socrates, it's always the person who does everything backwards, who says no to the status quo, that has something to say. Bernard Shaw once said, "We learn from the irrational man and woman. They reject the world as it is. They do not adapt themselves to it. They seek to change it.
I want to just quote a line from your new novelist, Stained White Radiance, and this is in a paragraph where Dave Robichaux, your detective, is talking about how his extended family is people who have a peculiar difference in their makeup. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about every time he thinks that some kind of constitutional sacrifice can be justified for the greater good, he wonders what his eccentric friends would say. And he says, then I realized that the rhetoric of the greater good, would have no effect on them, because for those who were most deeply injured as children, words of moral purpose too often masked acts of cruelty.
That's right.
Tell me how that observation came to you.
Well, anyone who spends any time, with 12-step groups or in analytical therapy or analysis is going to discover something about the nature of cruelty and how oftentimes it masks itself as love. And we all, at some time in our lives, have to deal with the nature of power and authority. And so very often people who suffer the greatest psychological injury in their lives are those who were treated erratically as children, not in a way that was consistently abusive. They were often hurt in some way, psychologically, physically, but were constantly told that this was an act of love, that it was being done for the child's own good. That person grows up with his head in a microwave. And the consequence is, as a rule, he has trouble with authority, defining it. He may spend a lifetime rebelling against it, or he may embrace it. He probably will misuse power himself. And one theme in the book deals with how an injury done a child is like a stone bruise, and it perpetuates itself in the person's adult life, where the injury is compounded, and it. This is why, you know, forgiveness and atonement and reconciliation among ourselves, to my mind at least, is so important. That person doesn't have to play the hand he's dealt with. You can put it away and say, "How about 5 new cards?"
I want to get back to your novel for a second.
Okay.
There's a group of characters who you describe in the novel as the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask you to describe the kind of person that you're talking about there and how you came up with that thought.
Well, I used to be a social worker in South Los Angeles, and the pool, these are the brain fried. These are the guys who, you know, arrive on this planet like, you know, a cannonball going through a stucco wall. They leave behind whole warehouses of paper, all kinds of records, parole and probation officers, marriage counselors, psychiatrists, social workers, bail bondsmen. These guys are the people with banana peels for fingers. And we think, my heavens, what are these guys doing in our society? But they provide employment for millions of other people, for guys like me who are social, who was, you know, a guy like me who was a social worker. People who complain most about these guys would be bereft if they disappeared, if the pool went away somewhere. I mean, how about all our, you know, policemen and psychiatrists, marriage counselors? What are they going to do for a job? That's on the kind of on the light side, but
you know, in a way, the way you're describing them, in a way, is not unlike the way you describe the kinds of eccentrics who
sure.
you're most interested in yeah. having as an almost extended family.
Yeah.
Are they the same people?
Sure, and I knew some great guys on Skid Row in Los Angeles. Yeah, East Fifth Street, as Woody Guthrie once said, is the skiddiest of the skids. And there was this one guy, I won't use his name, but he was a master at manipulation. And he would come into the office and demand that we place him in our best hotels, you know, our welfare hotels. As soon as he checked in, he'd throw all the furniture out the window, box springs. One time he ripped the laboratory out of the wall. It'd come crashing, you know, down under the cement from four stories high. And then he would run downstairs and haul it all to the secondhand store. This guy was...
Oh, to sell it.
To sell it. This guy was so infamous that in South L.A., the cops wouldn't arrest him because... This is kind of distasteful, but if they didn't cuff him right and he could get a finger down his throat, he'd throw up in the squad car.
Oh, God.
This guy was so awful, the jailer at Lincoln Heights didn't want him in his jail. He said, I couldn't take this guy anymore. That's a victory, a guy that could undo the system the way this one man could.
So it sounds like your relationship with him was more of like a novelist to a character than a social
sure,
worker.
Sure, I knew hundreds of people like this guy, just truly extraordinary human beings.
Could you communicate with him?
Oh yeah, sure.
Did you feel like you understood him?
Sure, and it's like any policeman will tell you that he knows many, many people like this man I describe. And that oftentimes there's a kind of symbiotic and sympathetic relationship between cops and certain kinds of people who inhabit the underworld. And they both sometimes understand the existentialistic rush that they get participating in a kind of nether society, a place that ordinary people don't put much time into. And that... You know, it's something interesting about being on the full tilt boogie all the time.
So when people could sense in you that you were not the straightest guy in the world, you know what I mean? That you were kind of eccentric yourself.
Well,
do you think? Well, but do you think that they would use that to try to take advantage of you,
no.
Or do you think that they would have more of a feel more kind of sympathetic or affectionate toward you because of that?
Most people I knew in that world had a wink of the eye at mm-hmm. respectability, and if you could share it with them, they knew you both had a kind of a Sancho Panza view of things.
James Lee Burke, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry, on your show.
James Lee Burke, recorded in 1992. His new detective novel is called Dixie City Jam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our summer reading archive edition and hear a talk with President Clinton's favorite detective writer, Walter Mosley. His detective, Easy Rawlins, is a black private eye from Watts. Denzel Washington will play him in the forthcoming film adaptation of Mosley's first mystery. Mosley's current bestseller is Black Betty. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Secretary of State Warren Christopher wound up a Middle East tour today in Damascus. He met with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad about peace between Israel and Syria. There seems to be no apparent agreement. The Israelis say they want peace, and then they will pull out of the Golan Heights, while Syria wants a withdrawal first. The BBC's Chris Morris reports from Damascus.
After his first stop in Damascus on Tuesday, Warren Christopher said he felt even more strongly that both Israel and Syria are serious about pursuing a peace settlement. There are no new ideas on the table, but the Americans believe their latest discussions have been substantive. They're pleased that moves towards closer relations between Israel and Jordan this week have not had a negative effect on their discussions with President Assad. But it is the Israeli-Syrian track of the Middle East peace process which is still proving most problematic. Senior U.S. officials argue that the complex issues of Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights and future security guarantees can only be resolved by painstaking attention to detail. They characterize both sides as skilled negotiators who are prepared to bide their time to get the right agreement.
Chris Morris reporting. Congressional leaders are keeping quiet about the details of their health care plans. They reportedly abandon many of President Clinton's proposals, but keep his demand for universal coverage. Key Democrats met with the president last night to tell him they'll propose different approaches to achieve the same objectives. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Democratic congressional leaders met with the president and first lady last night to deliver the news that Congress will consider legislation that will not be similar to what the administration put on the table. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says the plans that will be considered by the House and Senate will be less bureaucratic, more voluntary, and phased in over a longer period of time. House Speaker Tom Foley says the bottom line is to propose legislation that can receive majority support in the House and Senate. Perhaps the most controversial provision, the employer mandate, is expected to be softened, but Foley says the House will vote on the requirement that businesses pay for some portion of insurance coverage. But the leaders stress that the main objectives of the bills will be to provide affordable health coverage for all Americans. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
France says it will still pull its troops out of Rwanda by the middle of August, but it plans to keep some soldiers nearby. French officials say these troops will be used to help cope with the refugee crisis. Paris sent 2,500 soldiers into Rwanda in June to prevent further massacres of civilians during the civil war. Officials say they assured the rebel victors in Rwanda this week they'll remove their forces as planned, despite requests from the United States to keep them there. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 3 points today to close at 3,735. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Burma has agreed to meet with the United Nations Secretary General to talk about that country's human rights record. The agreement came when the foreign ministers of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations met in Bangkok. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
Ever since the Burmese junta took over in September 88, killing thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators and arresting thousands more, Burma has been a pariah state to much of the world, but not to Thailand, which made a point of inviting it to this year's ASEAN foreign ministers meeting. The Thais say the only way to get Burma to change is through constructive engagement. They point to the fact that the junta recently released scores of political prisoners and accepted a proposal by UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali to start a dialogue about how to move toward greater democracy. But international human rights monitors say, despite the junta's token efforts at reform to ease international pressure, it remains one of the world's most repressive regimes. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Bangkok.
The Kalima volcano in Mexico erupted overnight in a huge cloud of ash and rocks. At least 500 people were forced to flee from surrounding ranches. The volcano blew up last night just after 8 local time. There are no reports of any injuries or any deaths. The volcano is in a mountainous area of western Mexico. It's about 440 miles west of Mexico City and near the Pacific coast. Authorities say the capital is not in any danger. It's not clear if there'll be any more eruptions. A federal judge says General Motors can't charge some of its retirees for their health care. The automaker has to stop doing this while appealing an earlier ruling on the same issue. GM was ordered in February to pay health costs for 84,000 salaried employees who took early retirement. The company appealed that decision, and it's been charging the workers money per year or more for insurance. GM has now been prohibited from making other changes in the health benefit plan. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're featuring the authors of current bestsellers on this archive edition of Fresh Air. In May, I spoke with detective writer Walter Mosley. He has some pretty impressive fans. He's one of President Clinton's favorite mystery writers. Film director Jonathan Demme is bringing Mosley's first detective novel to the screen. The hero of Mosley's novels is Easy Rawlins, a black private detective from the Watts area of L.A. The first one, Devil in a Blue Dress, takes place just after World War II. Each subsequent novel finds Easy a few years older and living in a new political and social era. His new bestseller, Black Betty, is set in the early 60s. President Kennedy and Martin Luther King are giving Easy a sense of hope, but things are pretty grim at home. His wife has left him and taken his only birth child, money's running out, and it's hard to feed his two adopted kids. To make ends meet, he's taken on a case to find a woman who's disappeared. The book opens with a recurring nightmare about the night Easy witnessed his best friend Mouse commit a murder. Mouse gets into trouble in each of Mosley's mysteries.
I see Mouse as the hero of the world that Easy is talking about. He's a sociopath. He's very violent. He's willing to kill people, and it doesn't affect him. Easy is the hero of these books because these books are about him. But the world he lives in, Mouse is really the hero, the man who's willing to stand up and fight and not be pushed down for any reason. Not for a political motive, just because he's crazy. He's been driven crazy by the world he lives in.
Would you read the dream for us? And this is a dream of something that really happened.
Yeah, at least really happened in the book.
Right. Really happened in the book.
They were standing under a hard yellow light in the alley behind John's bar. Big Hand Bruno Ingram was large and powerful, and he had the ability to swagger even when he was standing still. He wore a brown mohair suit with no hat and no shirt. The smaller man's suit was close-fitting and silver, imported, I knew, from Italy. I stayed in the shelter of the doorway listening to their small talk, hidden. "Dodge has lost it," Mouse, the smaller man, was saying. "He sounded fine. You owe me 25 cents. "Come on, Sookie," a bodiless voice said from the street. It was a man's voice, a young man. "Uh-uh, Alfred," a woman answered as clear as you could want, but I didn't hear the rest of what she said. Bruno's bass voice was rumbling, "Get out of my face." I turned again, a sense of dread so deep in my body that it felt like the oldest thing in the world. "You could kiss my big black butt." He didn't mean it. That's what I wanted to shout out, but I couldn't make a sound. Mouse pushed against the big man's chest, not to move Bruno, but to push himself far enough away so that he could get out his long .41 caliber pistol. Bruno's manly sneer turned into an 8-year-old's wonder at what he'd done wrong. The impact of the first shot knocked him 4 feet backwards, big hands thrust out in front of him like a cartoon sleepwalker. He wanted to fall, to get down on the ground out of harm's way, but Mouse just kept on shooting, throwing Bruno up against the pork butcher's back door again and again. There was a scream, and I was stumbling backwards into the doorway.
Mouse is in jail as the novel opens, and when he gets out, he's looking for revenge against the man who turned him in for this murder. He's so different from Easy Rawlins. Easy Rawlins just doesn't have the temperament to rough people up. He can't rough people up to get information out of them. He's not that kind of guy. But do you know men like Mouse?
Oh, yeah. I made spouts on a friend of my father's, a man who used to hijack liquor trucks and bring cases of liquor to our house when I was a kid. And he would come over and he'd say, "Well, Roy," my father, he'd say, "Roy, why don't you keep these bottles of liquor for a week and I'll come back and get them later." And so when he would come back, of course, my father would have drunk a couple of bottles. And so the guy would say, "Well, you're going to have to pay me for those bottles now. Finally, he was in a crap game in a barbershop in downtown L.A., and he murdered a guy. He killed a guy. The guy owed him a dime, and he didn't want to pay it, so he killed him. He's in jail now.
Well, did you grow up thinking, how can a guy kill somebody over a dime?
Well, actually, I understood that. You know, the whole issue, I think, about worrying about, well, you know, it's not worth it to kill somebody over a dime. We wonder, well, is it worth it to kill somebody over $1 million?
Right.
You know, the issue is different. You know, if you don't have a dime, or if you come from a place where you have to fight for everything uh-huh. that you have, then you just fight. It's a natural reflex, because when you stop fighting, that's when you're going to lose.
So do you feel you understand why an insult can be cause enough? That can incite somebody to a murder.
Well, certainly, if you're living in a neighborhood where, you know, your rep is the only thing that you have, and if people can feel that they can insult you and push you around, well, then you're going to lose everything that you have in your life. And so you have to fight for things that seem ridiculous from an external point of view, but internally they make more sense.
So when this guy insults Mouse, Easy wants to say, hey, he didn't mean it, back off. But Mouse just kind of plugs him. What's your reaction to an insult when it comes your way?
Well, you know, I have, like Easy has, been able to move a little away from that place where I'm willing to fight at any moment. So if somebody insults me, it doesn't matter. If I'm walking down the street and I have $10 in my pocket and somebody wants to mug me, I'll give them the $10. I'll say, here's the $10. It's not worth, you know, it's not even worth me fighting. Even if I could beat you, it's not worth it. I might hurt my fist. But if $10 is all you have, see, I had like maybe $100 in the bank, so that $10 doesn't matter to me right now. But the life that Mouse was living and the life that Easy is very close to is a thing where you have to fight over everything. And so you stop discriminating between when you fight and when you don't fight. You just are always willing to fight. So Mouse, when he comes out of prison, there were three men in the bar. One of them turned him in, he thinks. So he's going to kill all three. That's just the way he does it, because that's the way he's going to keep his reputation up.
You have an opening quote before the book begins, Ghetto Pedagogy. Can I ask you to read it and tell us where this comes from?
This is a conversation I had with my father when I was a little boy. Ghetto Pedagogy. Dad? Yes. Why do black men always kill each other? Long pause. Practicing. I kind of like that. No, I was about 8 or 9, and my father had this, and I had this conversation.
So, when your father said practice, what did that mean to you?
Well, that there was a lot of anger and rage in the black community, and it was aimed at people outside of the community, which people really couldn't exercise that rage on at that time. But they still had to exercise it, and so it was on each other. But it was, in a way, getting ready for something that might not ever happen, but certainly it's getting ready for something.
Were you exposed to a lot of violence when you were growing up?
There was a lot of violence in the life. I don't think there's as much violence when I was a child as there is now. However, there was a lot of violence just in everyday life, just in the experience of everyday life. A lot of violence, a lot of anger, a lot of rage, a lot of despair. You know, I react more to psychological violence than physical violence. Physical violence is kind of easy to avoid or stay away from. But there's a kind of psychological violence in everyday life that black people and poor people in general experience in America.
What kind of psychological violence were you most exposed to growing up?
Well, just anger. You know, people who were angry all the time, people who were upset all the time, people who felt that other people were trying to take advantage of them. And sometimes they were right and sometimes they were wrong. Confrontations about everything, about how much something cost, about where you're going to go. I remember coming out of a restaurant with my father when I was, and my mother, when I was about, 12. And there was a valet parking, and so my father comes out and he gives the guy his ticket, and then another guy comes out after us, a white guy, and he gives the guy the ticket. And the guy goes directly to get the white guy's car and brings it back. And, you know, they get in. And my father goes up to the valet and he says, well, listen, you know, I want you to understand, in a very loud voice, I'm not going to give you a tip, and I'm not giving you a tip because you went and got that man's car before you got my car, but I was first. Now, I was, you know, 12. I was very embarrassed by this whole thing. But there, my father was angry. He needed to express that, so he needed to talk about what was happening to him. And I think that went on an awful lot when I was a child.
Do you think he was right in doing that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No question about it.
Is it hard growing up with so much anger and seeing all these slights all around you, and not grow up with a personality that's obsessed with victimization.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because even before you get to the point of whether or not you're a victim, you have to wonder, because people become so sensitive to these slights,
mm-hmm.
that sometimes there aren't slights. One of the things that Easy experiences in the books is that sometimes he's expecting a slight and it doesn't happen. And sometimes when he least suspects it, it does happen. And sometimes it's not from white people, it's from black people. It's very hard to figure out where you stand in the world. And it's hard not to feel you're a victim, especially when you are in certain ways. But then you have to begin to understand that we're all victims and that your job is to live your life and to survive, not to worry about what somebody next to you has or doesn't have or what they're thinking.
Now, your father grew up in the South, and, you're writing crime novels. There is violence in your books. Did your father tell you stories about the violence he was exposed to growing up in the segregated South?
One day, it's hard to talk about the segregated South because even though that really is a definition of what went on with my father, it's broader than that in experience. One day my father sat me down and explained to me, or told me, every person he'd ever seen die. It was just amazing. Little children killing each other, black children, black people killing white people killing black people killing, everybody killing each other, people being hung, people dying because there was not proper protection on their jobs. And then he went to World War II. And he talked about all the people that he saw die in World War II because he worked in statistics. So he typed up the names of everybody, all the Americans who had died. And finally, he came back to the South after that, and he found that all of his old friends, or most of his old friends who didn't go to war, had died also in, these kind of petty and stupid little fights and arguments and from disease in the South. And so he moved to Los Angeles. And when my father, this took a long time to tell me all of these deaths. And at the end of it, he said, "So then, Walter, I came to L.A., and I knew I was finally free. I was in a land where these kind of things weren't going to happen anymore." And he sits down in a diner, and the guy next to him has a heart attack, keels over and falls on my father's lap.
Oh, no.
And dies. And it was a good way to end it because it was a funny story. But also the idea of, there's segregation, there's violence because of racism and from ignorance and poverty, but also we all die. And I think that's what he was trying to tell me.
Writer Walter Mosley is my guest. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Walter Mosley is my guest, and his new novel in the Easy Rollins series is called Black Betty. The novels are set in L.A., and you're right. You could tell by some people's houses that they came to L.A. to live out their dreams. Home is not a place to dream. At home, you had to do like your father did and your mother. Did both your parents move to—I know your father moved to L.A. from the South. What about your mother?
My mother moved from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And she was my mother's Jewish, comes from from Eastern European stock, and her father was a doctor and very kind of dominant, I think, in a lot of ways. And she needed to get away from him and that family. And my father needed to get away from Jim Crow, so they were people looking for new lives, new ways. And you notice it in L.A. Everybody's looking for a new life and hoping that everything will open up for them and everything will change for them in Southern California.
Yeah, your mother is white and Jewish. Your father was black. I know some white people who have married black people have been in the absurd situation of finding that their families have disowned them for marrying a black person.
And black people, too.
And black people disown their person for marrying a white person. Did anything like that happen on either side of the family?
Well, it's interesting. It did to some degree. And it was very funny. The matriarch of my father's side of the family liked my mother, so she could never be completely ostracized. So she got along with her, invite her over, and would do things. And some of the family didn't like her, and that kind of wore off after a while, and they got along. And on my mother's side of the family, my grandfather just didn't understand. Even though he was a doctor, he didn't really think that black people and white people were the same, like, species. Not only not the same race, but the same species. But a very funny thing happened. He came to visit once to see his grandson because, you know, my mother demanded it and came out. And he was kind of taciturn. And he went away. And then my father built a house in the backyard, built a whole house. Floored it, walled it, plumbed it, wired it, did everything. And my grandfather came back and he saw this house. And then he saw that my father had built it. And so in a funny way, my father kind of proved that he was better than my grandfather, because my grandfather would love to do something like that and couldn't. And so then after that, my grandfather really liked him. It was a very kind of country thing, you know, because my grandfather was from he was from a rural background too. So my father in some way proved to him that he wasn't inferior. It was funny. Then they got along great after that.
So on the whole, did both families get along?
Oh, yeah. They got along great. When I was 13, I had a big party. I couldn't have a bar mitzvah, so I had a big party. And we invited both sides of the family over, you know, my Aunt Fanny and my Uncle Chaim and my godfather, Hollister P. Fontenot, and the Douglas family. And Hollister, who was 6'5", and the jokester on my father's side of the family, and Chaim, who was only 4'9", and the jokester on the other side, would stand in a corner telling each other jokes. It was wonderful.
That sounds great.
Yeah. By the way, all this conflict I was unaware of. Nobody in the family ever said it to me.
So how'd you find out?
Oh, when I was 30 or 35, I was talking to my mother about it, and she told me.
Huh. Now, I'm asking you this because place is so important in your fiction. You live in Greenwich Village in New York City now?
Right.
How did you choose that as the place to live?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of reasons, kind of social reasons. One, it's a pretty safe place to live. It's nice. It's easy. Mm-hmm. A lot of different kinds of people live there. Racially, a lot of different kinds, you know, Asians, Hispanics, blacks, whites, straight people, gay people. But also, the classes live together. One of the wonderful things about Manhattan that's different than L.A. and a lot of other places in the country is that they're not really class, separated by class so much. So you could have somebody who's living in a rent-controlled apartment, an old Italian lady, maybe 90 years old, living in a rent-controlled apartment, and next door, Charles Kuralt lives. You know, and down the street, Roy Lichtenstein lives. And I like that. I feel that I'm not kind of caught in any kind of particular way of being.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. This has been fun.
Walter Mosley recorded in May. His novel, Black Betty, is on the bestseller list. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have about Rwanda?
Well, we have news of President Clinton's announcement of a greatly expanded U.S. relief effort to the refugees who fled Rwanda to neighboring Zaire. We'll hear about that. And also about the new policy, it seems, of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees down in Zaire, which is to encourage Rwandan refugees to go back to Rwanda. To return to their homes. Those stories. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing a report from Maria Hinojosa in New York City about doing time as going to prison and how that is a rite of passage among certain young gang members in New York.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Singer Dorothy Collins died yesterday at the age of 67. Many people remember her best for the 7 years she sang on NBC's Your Hit Parade in the 1950s, for her work with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and as a regular on Candid Camera. I'll always remember her for her interpretation of Stephen Sondheim's song Losing My Mind from his musical Follies. She starred in the original Broadway production, which earned her a Tony nomination in 1971. Here she is singing Losing My Mind at a tribute to Sondheim, recorded in March 1973 at the Schubert Theater.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so, it's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, I think about you. And do they know, it's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon, doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me, or were you just being kind? Or am I losing my mind? All afternoon, doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you, spend sleepless nights. You said you loved me, or were you just being kind? Or am I losing my?
Dorothy Collins, recorded in 1973. She died yesterday at the age of 67. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Abby Beshkin. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with conductor Marin Alsop about her new recording of James P. Johnson's symphonic works. Also, Gerald Ladd on his memoir about growing up in the projects with a mother too caught up in her drug habit to take care of him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.